You're very welcome to this episode, guys. I have Seamus McDade, and he's a businessman and entrepreneur, and he is the owner of McDade's Football Special. Not a lot of people know of his history of being a sports agent, so I thought it'd be a great story to tell, the ins and outs of traveling the world and doing something that he loved doing before settling back to his roots in Remelton and taking over his family business.
I think the other advantage that we probably had is being based in Donegal means that, you know, your people who are consuming your product, who are not the locals, are probably coming to Donegal on holidays. So they will always, and so if they have a product that's synonymous with the county, every time they have a bottle of Football Special or think about it, it probably resonates happy memories with them. Yes. So, you know, and I meet loads of people now who say, oh, I had it in the Gaeltacht. That's, you know, that's a common one where I hear it from. So again, you probably had a good time with the Gaeltacht.
Peter Gallagher made the introduction with us too. So, and he's a trainer and obviously has started the expo. It was great to kind of get to find out a wee bit about you, because I had done a lot of research, a couple of headlines popped up. One being very controversial, and then one obviously with the Football Special. But if you could sort of give a basic like rundown of kind of your background, sort of. We'll start off with Football Special, and then I think we'll kind of diverge into the other headlines that I have for you. But yeah, it's a family business for yourself, close to your heart, I'm sure. But if you want to sort of give people a wee rundown of...
Yeah, well, Football Special is my family business. So my great-grandfather would have founded the business, and that would have been in the early 1930s, and that, you know, it changed over the years from what it was. We really developed the Football Special drink in the 50s and 60s, and that would have coincided. So my grandfather and all his brothers would have all worked in the business too, and that generation were really heavily involved with Swilly Rovers Football Club. So that is where the connection with football would have came in, and you know, the drink Football Special was developed then, but at the time we were bottling for Guinness. In them days, Guinness brewed in St. James's Gate and then had independent bottlers all over the country who bottled for them. Mm-hmm. In reality, that was just the transport network, the infrastructure development of the country. You couldn't send bottles all over the country I can't imagine what the roads network in rural Ireland in the 1950s was like. So There was lots of Guinness bottlers around the place. They developed then into being able to condition in the bottle, so that we ended up becoming a Guinness distributor for this part of Donegal. And that led us to having this empty factory where in the winter time we would be a lot quieter. So they started the developing flavors, and Football Special, you know, was born then. I think the brand didn't really kick off in the way it is now until the 80s, because the reality was in them days, we did a cola and an orange and a lemonade, and pre Coca-Cola entering the market, every region of Ireland would have had a small bottler who did that. So everybody would have just drank the local lemonade. It was only whenever 7-Up came in to the Irish market. And then again, you can imagine how long it took that to permeate from a Belfast or from Dublin to eventually get to, you know, somewhere like Donegal. So it was only at that stage that our Football Special started to become our biggest seller. And that's the way it's went on. So my dad my grandfather passed away in 1994, and my dad, you know, became full-time in the business. So I actually grew up in Dublin before that. And then we moved back to Remelton, and he took over running the business. And I'm back now living in Remelton just in the last year. So before that, I had my other career that I made headlines in. So, you know, now it's back to doing what the family business is. So it's, you know, it's just myself and my dad in the business now. I have four sisters, but as my mother says, they all have real jobs, so none of them work. So, you know, it's just me, and it's great. I mean, you know, it was always my ambition to return to the family business. So, you know, I was very, very fortunate that I was able to have another career. Yeah. I would have liked to have been more successful in that career and for it to be a bigger part of my life. But it was always my ambition to return to the family business. So, you know, I'm lucky I could do that.
Yeah, it's very close to your heart. It was mentioned in one of the articles that I did read. You had mentioned there that it was your great grandfather that started it up and everything. And what was the real legacy for it? Was it more, it was just something to fill in the time and the winter months? It's an empty garage and stuff, and you have the equipment there to produce something yourself, or was there something more there with your grandfather whenever he started it off? Or what?
I think there was probably a couple of advantages, but the first one was exactly what you said. It's whatever soft drink business, even today, you're going to be quieter in the winter time. You know, you'll have a boost at Christmas time, but it doesn't matter. You know, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, there's a winter month, so the consumption of liquids goes down. So, you know, we're always going to be quieter. One of my great uncles, Eamon, went to, one of the differences was the younger generations of my great uncles would have all started to become educated then. So one of them then went to work for a company in Belfast who were a big bottler, and they had a scientific end. You know, at the time there would have been a lot of, when we were mixing flavors, you know, it would have been like almost like a baker, like a home baker. It would be just throw a bit of that in, throw a bit of this, and if you get something nice, it tastes great. But there's no long-term future in that because you can't replicate that every time then.
Yeah.
So when my Uncle Eamon came back into the business, he had came from a big, proper, grown-up drinks factory. Mm-hmm. And so he started writing everything down. And so that's ultimately, so Football Special is 7 flavors mixed together. And it's very important. And some of the flavors is only very small. There's only hints of certain things. Yeah. So if you don't have the correct formula behind that, you know, you're not going to get the same product. So Eamon brought a level of professionalism then that meant that we started recording what we did. And that would have been, you know, unique as well. And that again is why it's the same. It's in essence the same formula from the 1950s until now that we use. There has been minor tweaks over the years, but it's been pretty consistent, and that's, you know, what people want. So, you know, we probably had that. I think the other advantage that we probably had is being based in Donegal means that, you know, your people who are consuming your product who are not the locals are probably coming to Donegal on holidays. So they will always, and so if they have a product that's synonymous with the county, every time they have a bottle of Football Special or think about it, it probably resonates happy memories with them.
Yes.
So, you know, and I meet loads of people now who say, oh, I had it in the Gaeltacht. That's, you know, that's a common one where I hear it from. So again, you probably had a good time with the Gaeltacht. It had very little to do with Football Special, but you're now associating us with a good time.
Yes.
And that's the nature. And that's where so many, you know, we've now started doing ice cream, and that's what I would see when I investigate, look at ice cream companies. Loads of them start at these beach resorts, because it's the same thing. You went there and you thought, this is the best ice cream I've ever had. It has to be of a certain quality, but if you're associating it with, well, I had a great day at the beach, then it's going to taste better. So, you know, and that's the advantage that we've had. Now, it's us, for our challenge now is how we then take that from here everywhere, you know, to the rest of Ireland and into the rest of the world, because they don't have that good associations. And that's, you know, that's a challenge we've had for a long time, and that's what I have to try and, you know, change moving forward.
Yes, even like there's a lot of people have that association where even after a game of football on a Saturday, like a young kid would have went to the shop maybe with their father and some of the other kids and maybe had a Football Special, and like it is that association. But was there any hard times, any times where you thought that it wasn't going to work or it wasn't going to be as successful?
Well, our biggest challenge. Every generation that, you know, every next generation that comes in, that's always a challenge, because, you know, every family business will tell you that, you know, the next, they have other ideas and it's always going to be hard to implement. But certainly in the last, you know, at the end of the last financial crisis we had in Ireland, you know, we were still a large wholesaler with a small soft drinks division in it, basically. And with the sort of, you know, it, again, like the soft drinks bottlers, there used to be small independent wholesalers for alcohol all over the country, you know, because that suited Guinness, really. Guinness could distribute it from Dublin to have, and they'd have a range of, I mean, there might have been 200 distributors, you know, of Guinness throughout the country. But as infrastructure has developed throughout Ireland, it now suits the bigger breweries like Guinness and like Heineken to have one centralized wholesaler. That wasn't possible in the 70s and 80s, but it is now, as you know, as roads have developed and what have you. So all the independent wholesalers in Ireland have really gone now, including our wholesale division. So, you know, our wholesale, you know, it pretty much collapsed as local pubs, as local rural pubs in Donegal started to close. That was our customer base. So the more and more of them closed, the more that we didn't have customers. And it was in about 2011 that we made the decision to close our wholesale and just focus on our own drinks. And at that point, there was a real question mark over whether the size of our own brand would be big enough to continue. Thankfully, people have stayed incredibly loyal to us, that they have continued to buy it, you know. And I don't just mean, you know, it's the end consumer is the most important person, but ultimately, if the shopkeeper doesn't buy off us, they won't be able to buy it. And all them shopkeepers have stayed just very loyal to us, and they've continued to purchase, you know, buy from us. So even though at one stage the McDade's rep would have been in and you would have bought maybe all your 7-Up from them or all your, you know, all your Coca-Cola, and then you just threw on a bit of Football Special at the end. Right. Now they just buy Football Special from us, but they've continued to keep their same order volume, you know, even though I know it's more of a hassle for them because now they have a Coke rep in as well. And it's, you know, it's extra business, but they've stayed incredibly loyal to us, which is what's saved us. So, you know, and then, you know, even obviously we look at something like what we're living through right now, and it's, you know, it's, that's a serious strain on a small business. So, you know, like any small business out there, our brand, I think, would lead people to believe that we are a bigger business than we are. You know, we still only have 5 people working with us. You know, it's a small scale. So any sort of hiccups are tough to, you know, to alleviate. So, you know, it's a constant challenge. But as I always say, as long as your sales are still growing or still constant, you have something there. And that's always been the way. So even though costs might go up and shops might close and, you know, that and them challenges will come, as long as people are buying the product, I'm still confident that we have a future there.
Yeah. And there's peaks and troughs, there's up and downs like as well, and you have to take the good with the bad. And it's great that you can kind of see that and work with that. But the one of the headlines, as I mentioned at the start, there was two, but one of them was the famous Football Special hits mainstream USA. So it's gone and moved to America. Is that still working? Or is that you still working on that?
So I mean, I was based. So I moved to, you know, I moved to New York with my sports agency career in 2011. And so I worked as a sports agent. But at the same time, I was still trying to look at where I could sell Football Special, you know, because I always worked in the family business as such. So, you know, over the years there, you know, I seen that there was this big, obviously there's a huge Irish community in New York, and there's especially a huge Donegal community. So, you know, we looked at how we could import and sell. And about 2013, I sold my first kind of shipment of Football Special, and that then morphed into more and more. And what I was able to find over there, I was able to find a bottler, a small soft drinks bottler, which, you know, doesn't exist in Ireland, really doesn't exist in Europe anymore, but there's still a role for that sort of person in the United States. So I was able to go to him, and he said to me, I'll charge you an hourly fee, but you can use my syrup room, we call it, which is where you mix the soft drinks. You can use my syrup room for this hourly fee, and you can bottle whatever you want. So I shipped the ingredients for Football Special over, and my dad flew over, and two of us mixed up, you know, 2 batches of Football Special, you know, and then bottled it in the United States. And that became the Football Special that then was sold throughout, you know, in America.
Wow.
And that opened up all sorts of channels for us, you know, because now the recipe is with them guys. They just manufacture a football special for me, but to the recipe and to my spec. And that, you know, it was a complete change. And that was a really great, you know, we sold in Boston and Philadelphia and New York was our main markets.
Yes.
And that's still an ongoing thing. It has taken a slight slowdown now that I'm based back at home, but it's still a market for us. And it's great. I mean, a lot of the times you're just fulfilling a need, you know, people are, you know, homesick in essence.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they want a bottle of football special and you know, they're, the goodwill that you get from that is worth way more than the value of it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, that's why we do it.
They're probably using it as cough medicine, maybe, whenever we're, you know, whenever you heat the Coca-Cola and stuff.
Yeah.
But did you see any, like, that must have been really difficult to find out what laws and stuff you have to do, what, you know, to kind of make the transition of bringing all your ingredients from Donegal in Ireland to New York, or, and that the process, like, was that difficult? Was it?
Yeah, I mean, that was incredibly difficult. Now, that is, you know, probably the big difference about this idea that they talk about people, you know, chasing the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
The level of encouragement you'll get, you know, from the ordinary person in America that you're trying to do this, you know, and even from the, you know, different government bodies and things. And I don't mean financial support. I mean, if you're saying, so I'll give you an example. I'm trying to bring in a shipment of stuff, of you know, of product, or even trying to bring in the ingredients. There's obviously a correct channel, which all this has to go through so that it's all FDA cleared and all,
yes,
this, you know, all what you do. So one of my shipments got held up. The FDA came and visited my premises and said, look, that label, it's not really correct. Because they call it, on the Irish labels, we would call it salt. In America, they call it sodium. So they were like, in theory, that's mislabeled. But everybody knows that salt and sodium is the same. And I can see that you're a pretty small operator. So look, fix it for the next time, but go ahead with that.
Right.
That is a sort of culture that does not exist in Ireland. You know, so all the challenges that I met, I always met with it. Well, here's a creative solution that you can get around. Because we can all tell that you're small and that you're trying to get set up. So rather than put you and Coke on the same level, you know, we'll cut you some slack. Whereas I find now, you know, especially since I've started developing my business here, it's very much, well, it's one rule for you all. Here is the rule and you're all going to follow the rule.
Yeah.
You know, which I can see why people would say, well, that's fair. But it's also, you know, it's also not in practice. It's not relevant for smaller businesses of any sort. You know, yes, it's, you know, you know, it's, and we'll certainly see where, you know, the regulation that's going to come down the line now post this coronavirus.
Yeah,
which is all important, and it would be something that, you know, you could see in a gym setting. You know, where it's going to be, they're going to make people heavily clean equipment and things. But the challenges that they're going to put on a small independent gym owner is going to be equal to what they're going to put on a big multinational gym chain.
Yeah.
And it's not relevant because the people who are coming into the small person as well probably appreciate that there's a lower scale there anyway. So,
yes,
you know, it's not always consumer focused. So we met a lot of challenges. We had a lot of, you know, I imported some other products that didn't work, that we had to destroy. And, you know, it was a real learning curve.
Yeah.
But that, you know, is kind of the life, I guess, you know, that's where I learned my entrepreneurial lessons, really. So that was, you know, I cut my teeth there.
What age were you then?
I moved to America when I was 21. So we set up McDade's Beverages USA when I was 24. And that really became, you know, and by within a couple of years, we were doing about a container every 6 weeks into America. But it became much more, we wholesaled all Irish food and drink. So Football Special became a small part of a larger business.
Right.
We sold Tato and Barry's Tea and, you know, Club Orange and everything else that you would, yes, want there. So, you know, so that became a full service. We were a full service Irish import food company. And then I also met a butcher there who we developed a range of Irish sausages. So we were able to, you know, because it wasn't Irish pork, but it was Irish seasoning. So it tasted as close to an Irish sausage could taste.
Yes.
You know, and that was a great learning curve. But again, America allows you the opportunity to do these things. It would be a lot more difficult to do that here.
That's amazing, man. That's quite the story. Like, and it's great that those things that you have set up, they're still going, they're still being used today, and it's a good success. Look, you mentioned there a couple of times through talking about Football Special, but you, again, you studied the sports management at UCD.
Yeah, that's correct, right? Yeah.
And so the big dream before the Walter McDade's Football Special was sports agent. Is that right?
That's yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was my, I know, I think I said this when we met at the Expo, but I seen the movie Jerry Maguire. This sounds like it's exactly a corny a story as you think it's going to be. So I seen that movie and said that's a job I think I could do. Because I very quickly realized at about 11 or 12 years old, I had very little talent for sport, but generally enjoyed it. Yeah. So I just really wanted to hang out with talented people. So I thought, well, how can I use my talents to help them? So, you know, that was where I thought my career, my interest in business, and, you know, I thought, oh, I think I could do this sports agency. I think I'd be good at that job. And I, you know, I always thought from a young age, I've got a nice feel for business, so I get this concept, mm-hmm. And I get sport, so maybe I could do this job. So that was the career that I thought, I absolutely want to do that. So I went to UCD to study sports management, which is what, you know, I thought that would be the way to get into the business. So that's, yeah, you know, that's where it started, really.
And do you see some things correspond, even like, because it's a management type thing, would you still see that the same characters he's come across and which you can use in Dades, or was it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And that was one of the reasons that I sort of parked the sports agency career, was because I still believe if I can make a huge success of Football Special, I'll actually be able to advise aid players anyway. Yes. Because especially because of the brand that we have, if I can grow the brand Football Special, then I can grow your brand if you're a striker for some football club or whatever, you know. Yeah. It's going to be similar. So if I can figure out, yeah, I would, there are similar characteristics, you know, and you're, and again, if you, I have a brand that's called Football Special, I'm probably going to be involved and meet people who are in the sports world anyway. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't, and that's what I always said, it doesn't hinder my doing that again, but, you know, that was,
you, yeah, because I think you've sponsored like the was it the Foy Cup or not?
Sponsored the Foy Cup, and now this year we had big plans to do something with Derry City and Finn Harps this year.
Yeah.
Now that's, you know, who knows, but we'll do it next year, or we'll do it whenever it's safe, yeah, to have, you know, games again. So I would imagine, yeah, we'll always, you know, have some association with sport.
Awesome. Now, the major headline that I saw with your career as a sports agent, it sounds like a long story, but In Pursuit of Murphy and McBrearty, it sounds like a horrible love story here, but the next line would be, the Remelton native was the controversial Australian-Irish recruitment coordinator and was heavily involved in the pursuits of both Michael Murphy and Patrick McBrearty. So can you tell me a wee bit more about that and how that came about?
Well, I suppose when I went to UCD and we started, you know, studying sports agency, obviously there are loads of people out there that dream of being a sports agent. I'm not unique. There's plenty of teenagers think that's a great job to do. And there, again, there's plenty of people a lot smarter than me and things that could do it. Mm-hmm. So what I thought was, I'm going to have to try and find my niche. How am I going to get in here? So one of the things that I saw was, I remember watching at the time, RTÉ done a documentary on the O'Halpine family, and Setanta O'Halpine had just led Cork. I think they were beating the Ireland final, but he was the breakout hurling star that year. And he'd just been recruited to play Aussie Rules. Yeah. So he was leaving to do that. So there was a TV show on that. And I remember in the TV show, they interviewed his agent, who was an Australian called Gerald Charlie. And I thought to myself, why could an Irish person not go to Australia, set up a sports agency and just represent the Irish lads? Because at the time there was about six players.
Yeah.
Because chances are you have a similar lifestyle style to them. You have a similar upbringing. They'll probably sign with you over some random Australian guy. So that was always in the back of my mind. And when I went, you know, when we was in UCD, we were studying more, this controversial agent called Ricky Nixon came up with basically that idea. What he said was, there's always been clubs going back since the 1980s. There's always been Australian rules clubs that have looked to Ireland for players. There's a limited pool in Australia because, you know, Australia is a small enough place in the global scheme of things. And Aussie rules football is really was certainly only played in the state of Victoria. That was where it was at its strongest. So of the 18 Aussie Rules clubs, 14 of them are based in Victoria. So it's all about that state. Now, it's got a lot stronger in South Australia and Western Australia over the years. But, yeah, you know, at one stage, it was really there. So they've always looked to Ireland for players. What Ricky came devised was the only clubs that were coming to Ireland were the massive mega clubs. So you're Collingwood, who are the biggest club. And Collingwood are one of the biggest sports franchises in the world. They're up there with your Dallas Cowboys and your Man United. They're the massive clubs, so they dominate everything. So they have always got the biggest budget, so they'll always come to Ireland. Ricky's idea was, I will charge you, the club, a fee, and I'll run your scouting in Ireland. On top of that, I'll say to the Irish boys, I'll be your agent. So, you know, I'm getting the fee. In essence, I'm getting a fee from both, because I'm going to get a percentage of the players' wages and I'm going to get a fee for finding them, which is exactly what the the big soccer agents do. You'll hear it all the time. They get a fee for moving one player from one club to another, but they'll also charge a player a fee of their wages. So it's exactly what they do. So I read about Ricky's idea. I managed to get in contact with Ricky, and at the time he was running an online course called How to Be a Sports Agent. So I thought, this is a way to get in front of Ricky. So I signed up for his course. It was a Zoom, it was an old style Zoom. And in the course of the course, he came to Ireland, and I managed to blag a meeting with him. And I managed to, you know, really just take over one of his little online lectures one day when we talked about Ireland. And we came off the Zoom call, and he said, do you want a job? You don't want a job. Ricky had no concept that I was still a first year student in UCD. This didn't resonate, because he just thought, this is the guy who's on my course, who speaks well. Because it was all, there was no camera. It was all just headsets. So we were all just talking on this, It was an old style video chat, whatever, but no video, sorry, just an audio chat. Mm-hmm. So Ricky offered me this job, and I thought, yeah, great. So he said, go draw up your list, your short list of players. We're going to run this camp. Now, this is where the advantage of being my age was. A lot of the players, he really wanted players that were between 18 and 22. So a lot of them players were, if not in UCD, they were based in a college in Dublin. So it was easy enough for me to get in contact with them guys, because they were kind of in my peer group. So I was hanging on, trying to play football at UCD, but I was in and around the squad of UCD panel. So there was a couple of boys who were on the team. I was like, okay, you boys are definitely good enough. And then from that, I was able to get phone numbers. So we put together this camp. I was in Brafey in Mayo. That was the very first one. Ricky being, the kind of entrepreneur he is, he then managed to rope RTE into this. And he said, you guys should follow me. This would be the X factor for Irish boys going to play. So he managed to get them to commission a documentary. They came, followed us around, followed the players around. And we had five clubs, five Aussie Rules clubs, and two boys got signed out of that process. Mm-hmm. So at that, I said to Ricky, well, Ricky, I really should come to Australia now to manage these boys, because you don't have anybody in your office looking after them. So he said, okay, come when the season starts. So I waited, and then I came for my summer months in college. So I came and said, right, maybe I'll stay longer term, but we'll see how it goes. I peer pressure from my parents and my lecturers, maybe come back and finish my course in UCD. And then I went back out as soon as the course was over to manage I ran his whole Irish operations.
Wow.
So we looked after, the recruitment, we looked after the scouting and recruitment for, it ended up being seven Aussie Rules clubs. And then I looked after the management of them players when they came to Australia then. It was a great journey. I mean, it was really, to see, it's exactly what an agent wants to do. I mean, one of the best examples was somebody like Michael Murphy, has been obviously quite famous. Mm-hmm. From since he's quite young. He's always been a brilliant player, whatever, and he's always been well known. We found Jamie O'Reilly was a guy playing for down under 21s, and I brought the agents, I bought the Aussie Rules scouts. We went to see an Ulster under 21 semi-final. It was down against Armagh up in Belfast one night, lashing rain. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Jamie O'Reilly, really stood out, not as a GA player, but as an Aussie Rules player, because he had all the attributes that you would say, right, that lad looks like he could play Aussie Rules. He ran everywhere. He kicked the ball well. He had good hands. But he wasn't a star. He on his team of down team players, he was probably the fifth or sixth best player. But you could tell he'll do well. And we recruited him. Richmond Football Club offered him a contract. When they brought him for a trial, he just trialed sensationally. He did all the things that you would want from a player. I mean, I remember he'd done a thing. He memorized what every single player on the panel looked like before he walked into the dressing room. So he got on, he got a match program. He looked up what every Richmond player, there's 40 guys on the squad. He looked up what every single player looked like. And when he walked into the dressing room, he was able to introduce himself. And they were like, "How do you know my name?" And he said, "Oh, like, I just looked up your names." And so they made him go around the dressing room, and he was able to name every single person in the room.
Wow.
Which the club were like, "This guy, wow. Like, if he's doing that, what's he going to put into his body to perform like? This is unbelievable." So, you know what, he went on to play, I think he played 15 times in the Aussie, in the AFL. And I was there, I was in the dressing rooms, and they handed him his jersey for his first game. And that was like, you've come full circle there. That's an incredible journey I've had with him. You know, and that was the joy of what you get from that job, like, of really, finding somebody and then seeing how their career can progress.
Of course, like, would 15 matches, with 15 in career appearances, would that have been a full contract? Would it not be a little bit more? Or what?
So he spent 3 years. So again, he spent 3 years. So when they went first, they were on their rookie deal, which was a 2-year contract, but you couldn't play a senior game on your rookie deal. That was an introductory deal. So the way that it works, it's still similar now. So you've got 40 players on your main squad. Yeah. Then you're allowed a secondary squad of 10, who are your emergencies if there's injuries. But the second you promote them into your 40, they're now in your 40. So you have to drop somebody out of that and what have you. So most of the Irish boys go on the rookie list first. So he spent a year on the rookie list. Then they promoted him. He played. Then his second year, he played a lot more games. And his third year, they kind of demoted him back to the rookie list, because that's usually what they can do with Irish boys. Because at that point, you're so kind of invested. Why would you not? But it means you're going to be playing reserve football probably until at least halfway through the year, because halfway through the year they'll start cutting their senior players because they're probably out of contention to win it. So you may as well give the young lads a chance then. So, if you start on the rookie list, it's very hard to break in that season. So they put him back in the rookie list, and ultimately Jamie, because you kind of get an idea of what sort of person he was, they don't make massive sums of money. And he thought if he didn't go back to finish his course in Queens were going to make him start again. And he just thought, I've done this now. I've been there, done this. I'd like to go on with the rest of my life.
Yes.
So he decided, at that point, he's like, I'm never going to be a superstar. And it's like, I'm sure I could probably play and bounce around for another couple of years, but I'd rather go back to university and finish that off. And, he came back. So his wasn't an overly successful career by terms of numbers.
Yeah.
But, it was just a good story, I guess.
Yes, and, absolutely.
He was incredibly, it's always nice, I think, when athletes can make their own decisions, when they can decide, I've had enough now, I feel fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Because people who play 200 times don't feel like that, because they always feel like they're cut short, in some way, shape or form.
And that is a nice story. How long was this stint of you working in Australia, being that agent for those guys? It was about three years.
So I lived out there for 2 years, and then it was 1 year here. I think a couple of things then happened to finish it. There's one main reason, and then there's the bit of crack. But the main reason was at the time. So as I say, the Irish boys were always on the rookie list. But separate to the rookie list, you could have two international slots. So you could sign two players as an international rookie, and they didn't come against your salary cap, but they didn't count as a slot on your roster. So it was a free shot. You may as well do it. Once your club could afford, you may as well do it. The Irish boys didn't class as internationals because the GAA had said, which is they were very right to do, they had said to the AFL, if you want to continue the international rules, you can't be just taking our best players. So they Irish boys counted as Australians. So now the clubs really needed to be sure that they were going to take the kid on, because now you were comparing them to another Australian, not just another, they'd often take flyers on like good American basketball players, or good New Zealand rugby players, same thing. They take a chance on them. Irish boys were competing with Australians. Eventually, the Aussie rules, the AFL did a deal with the GAA whereby the Irish players would be allowed to be classed as international players, but the AFL would guarantee the international rules series for the next 10 years which is huge for the GAA coffers and is great for everybody to play international sport, you know, in a domestic game. And on top of that, the AFL said that they would run the recruitment and scouting. So they would cut agents like Ricky Nixon,
right,
regarded as unscrupulous agents. They would run a centralized recruitment base, and all the players would go into a system and the clubs would pick from that, but it would all be managed by the AFL. So nobody could accuse an agent like myself of, you know, of doing this. So that meant that there was really no role for me in terms of recruitment anymore. Now, there still would have been a role in managing the players, but there would never be in the recruitment.
Yes.
Seems like a good strategy, it's not a great strategy for the players. Because now there is no, I mean, for example, Jamie O'Reilly, the second we seen Jamie O'Reilly, Richmond were ready to offer him a contract that night because they said to me, you can't tell the other six clubs that are in your scouting network, you found this player, we want him. And I had to say, well, if you want him, you're going to have to pay him for me to take him off my, you know, and you're going to have to make him a contract offer now. So I was able to manipulate the situation to get Jamie a contract quicker than he maybe could have.
Oh, wow.
Somebody like Michael Murphy is a good example, or Tommy Wallace was the big one. Because Tommy Wallace was so famous, he had four Aussie Rules clubs that were after him,
mm-hmm,
which was great. Tommy was able to drive the price up. But it also meant the smaller clubs knew we're never going to be able to compete with that. And that's what sort of happened now. You know, the bigger clubs take most of the Irish boys now because it's all in one pool. There's no little gem that's just being found out there anymore because it's all centralized.
Yeah.
So that was ultimately, my role was going to have to change. At the time, Ricky had arranged, he had said, look, and I was still only 21 at this stage. So he was like, for your career to really grow, you need to go to America and see how sport works on a grand level. Well, you know, if you go there, work there for a couple of years, you'll learn so much. You come back here and take their ideas and, you know, and implement them here. So he had set up a meeting with me with the America, the NFL Players Association. He had went and worked there for 8 weeks when he was starting out. Mm-hmm. And he still had his contacts there. So we said, go and meet them guys. So that was my next step. Just before I left, Ricky got into some trouble with the law and became, you know, front page, back page news. You know, he had lots of issues. He had lots of demons that he had to deal with. So it was a good jumping off point for me anyway. The job was probably not going to last because, as I say, the AFL had sort of cut me out of a job. I don't think Ricky's company was going to keep me on because of the way that his life was unraveling.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it was a good time for me to jump off then. So I had probably learned as I got as much from it as I was going to.
Yeah.
Without me then really starting to, I mean, I started to recruit Australians, but I hadn't really heavily got into it, really learning my trade.
Yeah.
Then. So off I went to America. So about 3 years I did it.
Very good, man. And like, obviously, whenever you first started, the characteristics to what you were looking for and what the Australian rules needed, you kind of learned those skills, didn't you? Because you were sort of recruiting badly, sort of, we'll say badly at the start, but I mean, you were looking for...
Oh, absolutely. I think, so the only Aussie rules that we got was, I remember there was highlights on TG Carr.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess it's actually the same as any sport. If you only watch the highlights of sport, you're only going to see, you basically see the people who score the goals, like in essence, you know, because that's what the highlight of a sport is. So mm-hmm. I only ever seen, yeah, the goals. And the goals are always the big, tall, full forward catches the ball, kicks it through the posts.
Yes.
So I thought what they're looking for is that player.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Australia, like in the first recruitment camp I did, I remember sitting down with one of the scouts. I think we had 30 boys there. And he literally drew a line through 25 of them and said, like, oh, why are you even like, these 25 are so far off our radar. You're wasting my time, Seamus, having these guys here. So I was very fortunate that they all took me under their wing and said, come in and work in our, you know, come into our recruiting department and have a look. The Aussie Rules clubs are not like big Premier League clubs. You know, yeah. They're much more similar to a League of Ireland club than they are a Premier League club. You know, they're small, some of their staff are still part-time. They'll spread, they'll share ideas. They're not, you know, it's not a huge multinational business.
Yeah.
So I was able to go into their recruitment rooms and they taught me, look, this is what we want from an Irish player. We want running halfbacks. The basics was, and this is the same for any sport, if you play behind the ball, it's a lot easier than playing in front of the ball. So, you know, any back is a lot, it's really easier to be a defender in any sport than be an attacker, because all you got to do is stop the other guy, you know, and all the play is in front of you. Mm-hmm. So they were like, if we only have an Irish boy in a 2-year contract and we want them to eventually play for us, odds are he's going to be a defender. Because again, we can teach him defense a lot quicker than we can teach him offense. And every single Irish player that goes who makes it as a success is a halfback or a midfielder. There's no forwards. Like, they don't
make it. I lost my chance.
So that completely changed. But then you're like, and I remember when I first started doing it, you know, you're looking at lighter, you know, smaller, fitter players that you would think. Yeah. But the Aussie rules I see is all these big hits and like overhead catches. But that was just, you know, the naivety and my lack of experience in the sport that you know, that had done that to me. So it was a big learning curve, you know, and it would make me be very reluctant to comment on any other sport again, you know, at that level without doing real good research into it. Because, you know, I thought I knew a bit about Aussie rules. But again, if you don't, you're not studying the tape and watching long enough, you know, that you're not seeing a lot of that.
And have you any?
That's what really hurt me when I started. When I then went and started doing American football, I was struggled greatly at getting the nuance of American football. So I was very difficult for me to recruit players in that, because I couldn't take out a lot of what they were doing.
Oh, big time! American football is like, again, that's like a whole something. Yeah. Do you still follow it now?
Yeah. So I do. Yeah. So I still follow it, but obviously. Again, I can follow it now as a fan, which is great.
Right.
You know, so the agency, you know, to move the story on a bit, the agency they ended up working with in America was a crowd called 320 Sports. And they specialized in offensive linemen, which are obviously, you know, if people don't know American football, they're the guys who protect the quarterback. So if anybody's ever seen the movie The Blind Side, that's, you know, that's a left tackle. That's what they do. That it's very smart. My boss at the time, a guy called Sonny Shah, you know, he specialized in that. They get paid after the quarterback. They're the second highest paid position in the league, because if you can't protect your quarterback, you know, you lose the game, really. So they become, you know, it's very smart business practice to manage them. But their position is incredibly skilled, and it's very, very difficult to really know what they're doing without being an expert in that field. You know, it's all very like how quick their hands are. So when I went to do that job again, they were like, okay, you got to watch what the right guard is doing, you know? And it's like, wow, you know, wow. Like this is really technical information on the sport. Mm-hmm. And now I got up to a passable level, but Aussie rules was so similar to Gaelic football.
Yeah.
I knew a lot about Aussie rules, you know, within 6 months, like.
Yeah, and did you find it challenging then to kind of adapt to those characteristics that you needed to find? Or did you find that you sort of took it under because, like sports management, the degree, had you finished that at this stage?
Yeah, I finished my sports management degree, yeah. And I probably could have done the math. And I mean, I did manage the players and looking after their day-to-day affairs was okay. But even when we were negotiating contracts, you know, obviously anybody knows about American sports is very stats heavy. You know, and even the statistics that they want you to pull when you're negotiating, you know, you'd want to be in, you know, that there's a reason that there are people who do maths at Harvard who work for NFL clubs, like, you know, because they're able to, you know, the sabermetrics, they're able to really cut into the numbers and see it. And so I could do it, but I'm not sure. The only way I could have really done that job at a really good level was to work with a team of other people, you know, and we were too small an agency for me, you know. Really, the idea was we would be able to do everything, you know, and that was a challenge. Had I more of a hunger for the sport, I would have learned that. I've no doubt anybody would have learned it. You know, you're not trying to come up with the statistics. You're just trying to figure out how to manipulate them to fit your story. You know, but I think that's where I probably fell down on, well, how much do you really love this sport? How much do you really want to get into the nitty gritty of it, you know, and learn exactly what's going on here?
So what would you sort of say to someone who is like looking to get into that sport management and stuff? Like,
I think it's a great field. I mean, it's an incredibly competitive industry. You know, so I had done 3 years working in Australia I went to America, done a couple of weeks working with the Players Association, and I worked for 320 Sports, and I got paid $500 a month to work for them. So on the side, I was working on a building site. So right. At this stage, I'm 22 with 3 years experience, and that's the offer. And the, you know, anytime you go in to negotiate your own salary, they'd say, well, you know, he'd have a stack of CVs. Well, which of these guys do you want to replace you? You know, and it's so if you're going to do it, you're going to have to be prepared that you're going to have to hustle very hard. You know, you're not going to make any money for a long time at it, unless you happen to sign somebody at a young age and keep a hold of them, you know, mm-hmm. which can happen, but it's probably, you know, unlikely. So you're going to have to really slog for a long time. The second thing I'd say is you're going to need to know marketing. You're going to need to know the sport anyway, because you're going to be found out very quickly. You know, you're going to sit in a room with a player, even on a social occasion, he's going to know if you don't really know the sport, you know. Yeah. Now you don't need to know, as I say, you don't, and sorry, the more you know, the better you'll be. You know, the just really, really, you know, you're going to really need to read up on the sport and know everything about the sport. And then the third thing is you're going to need to learn how to market them players, you know, what it is, what brands would want to be associated with them and why, you know, and if you can do them, you know, three things, everybody talks about this legal aspect of it. The reality is most player contracts in, certainly in team sports, in the more major sports, even a Premier League player, it's a standard Premier League contract that's negotiated with the Players Association and the Premier League. So yes, all the terms may be different, but it's a standard contract. So you can actually learn the contract language relatively quickly. It's not that confusing. Right. All that's confusing is how much money. Your job then is to get the percentage that's his wages, to get that up. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not that. So I wouldn't get too held up over trying to learn the legalities of it, because lots of people I met, even in my career, went off and did law degrees, and I don't really see a whole lot of, you know, it's certainly important, but you can skip over that. And then the last part that you're going to, which is the really, this is the intangible. You're going to have to sell, because you're going to have to get in front of a player. And if that player is any way successful, he's going to have a bunch of agents after him. He or she, has a bunch of agents. And you're going to need to convince them and their families that you're the right person for them. And then, you know, you're going to have to sell their talents to a team. And even if you're managing, if you even think about when the person was the agent for the 15-year-old Messi, nobody knew he's going to become Messi. And they're saying, you know, they're looking at Barcelona, they're going, we have so many good players. Yes. You're going to tell me this 15-year-old kid is going to be better than Ronaldinho. You know, we've seen Ronaldinho at this age. You know, so you're going to have to convince him, no, he is going to be just as good. So you have to sell him or her to the team. So you're going to have to be able to, you know, you're going to have to be able to sell. And that's where somebody like Ricky Nixon, for all his faults, incredibly good salesman and knows his angles. Like, you know, didn't just come to Ireland, came to Ireland and decided, I'm going to do a TV show as well, because I know every person in Ireland is going to be watching this TV show. Every 18-year-old boy is going to see this show and then is going to say, well, I'm the agent. I want to sign with this guy. You know, so that's where you're trying to, you know, manage the expectations for people.
Exactly. I think, is it something that could be tapped into more? Because you've said the AFL have taken over all the scouting and everything. But is there something there, maybe a TV program or something, that would create more hype? And Sky's doing GAA now. They're covering the GAA. And do you think money's going to be involved now in the GAA to pay players? Or, you know, where do you think the future of that will go?
It's hard to know. I would, you know, it's going to continue to get more and more professional unless somebody, you know, brave inside the association decides, no, this is going too far. We don't want an elitist organization. I don't foresee that happening. So I think it's going to get more and more professional. Will it ever get to the point that players are earning money? You know, maybe not. But there are certainly players already who are semi-professional anyway from their endorsements. You know, and again, if you want to be a good agent, there's probably a scope there to manage a lot of them players. And there are a couple of people who dip their toes in the water in that. You know, so there's probably a role in that. The other thing is, there's, you know, with new media streams popping up, you know, there are ways to manage players, you know, and get streams of revenue for that. I could see if you met a player who was comfortable to do this, you could really do a really interesting, you know, review of the weekend action with a current intercounty player, and that would certainly get a lot of traffic online. Now that player, you know, and that you'd get sponsorship and all sorts of stuff. That player is going to have to deal with the issues that come along with, you know, a team may not like him doing that. But, you know, again, the more and more we get into these new medias, maybe that is something, you know, that becomes irrelevant. And so, yeah, there'll be scope. There'll always be, you know, there'll always be opportunities there. There'll always be opportunity. And even in different sports, in esports, there's lots of people out there. You know, the one advantage you have, if you're a teenager watching this and you're thinking, I'd like to do this job, I guarantee you a 35-year-old has no clue what esports are. So get out there and learn who your esports people are, because there's a gap in the market in that. Go and manage them. Don't worry. Anybody can go down to, you know, Derry City's under 17s and pick out the best player on the pitch. You know, so there's probably somebody already looking at him. But, you know, does everybody know what the best Minecraft player is? Like, no, is the answer. But you probably do, because they're in your age group. So,
yes.
You know, there's always opportunities.
Very good. Are you still going to be in and working around being an agent and managing players? Or have you sort of put that on the side burner with everything going on there at the moment? Or
no, I parked that just because it would be unfair on my other business, I think. I just wouldn't have the time to do it. I still get the very odd, infrequent phone call from people. You know, I want advice on things. And I'll happy to do that. But no, I've parked it for now. You know, we'll see. Hopefully we can restart. As you can see, I had great crack to it. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah, it was great. And I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed helping the players. I really did. Yes. I mean, the players... Player agents get an awful rap in the media. And I never really understand it, because if anybody said, I have a person who goes to my boss and negotiates more money for me, like, no, everybody would say, oh, but that's smart. Well done. But a player gets somebody who does that, and they all think that, you know, the general media thinks what an awful thing the agent has done. I never understand why anybody has any sympathy for the Glazer family. Like, do they think that if Alexis Sanchez doesn't get this money, the Glazers are going to give it to charity? They're just going to make themselves richer. So they may as well give it to the player. So, you know, that's, you know, I have a great enthusiasm for sports agency. I think the players are, you know, in many, many instances, when the power is with the clubs, they treat players badly. So I very much enjoy being on the side of players.
Right.
You know, in my time. So I loved it, but no, it's parked for now, but hopefully one day.
Yes. Well, that's excellent, man. Really great story, and it's a great lesson for people. Have you any sort of final thoughts that you want to, any sort of, the name of the podcast is kind of, it's called Breaking Inertia. So the reason for that is kind of, say if you're doing a deadlift, you have to, say it's 200 kilo and you have to lift the weight of 200 kilo, you have to put on a wee bit more effort than 200 kilo to actually get that moving.
Yeah.
You kind of touched on a few things. So breaking that initial inertia, working a wee bit harder than what you initially think, or going through a tough stage. You mentioned a few things there, but is there any last words you would kind of say to people in business or sports management that you would say to help encourage them if they are going through like a rough patch or a difficult time?
Well, I guess just, I mean, you know, when I started getting in touch with Ricky Nixon and things, you know, people said to me, oh, this'll never work. Like, is he really going to take you, an 18-year-old, seriously? You know, and I would say that a lot of people said that to me. And like a lot of my friends, I mean, good people. I don't mean negative, you know, pessimistic people. I mean, good people said, is this really going to work? So the people, you know, you're going to have to move forward, you know, to take risks in life. There is a huge element of bravery. And if you believe it's the right thing to do, you are going to have to really believe that and try and just like not listen to the doubters. So even if you're looking at now and you're, you know, I know a lot of your people are in the gym business. Like, you know, there's a lot of online videos now. If you're somebody who's a little bit embarrassed in front of the camera, everybody's, you know, that's completely reasonable, you know, but, and it, yeah, it's going to be a bit cringy, but just keep at it. Just keep doing it, because that is probably where the future that's going to be. And it will be embarrassing, and it will be, you know, I it was embarrassing for me to talk to Ricky Nixon first. It wasn't like I was like super confident when I first went in the door. And we made loads of it. As I say, the 30 players I recruited the first camp, 25 of them were not anywhere near good enough. You know, so you're going to, I know, I just think people need to have the encouragement, you know, just take your chances, take your risks. If you believe it's the right path to go down, it will work. And, you know, just keep growing, doing whatever you've got to do. Believe in yourself and back your ability and it will come good. But, you know, it'll be a slog, but don't worry about that. And don't listen to, you know, and this is not a negative. Don't listen to the haters. That's not what I mean. I just mean just nobody will know how cringy it is to stand in front of the camera but you. But just do it for the first few and it'll get better and get better. Mm-hmm. And you'll continue, you'll grow. And you'd be amazed because here I was 18 and I turned out I had a job. And my other classmates were like, this is unbelievable. And then people would say, you're incredibly lucky. And I'd say, but you're the same people who said to me, I shouldn't be doing this. You know, so it's, you know, you're just that, yeah. You know, keep plowing ahead with ideas.
Excellent. I think that's a great way to finish. Words of encouragement there. Seamus, I really appreciate you taking the time, especially whenever you're so busy and during these tough times and the pandemic and things. I really value your time, so I really appreciate that. We'll get this on online.
No, that's great. No, I appreciate it. Great talking to you.